Hello, my name is Jody Lamont, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. Recently, or at least at the time I recorded this, the number one selling book on Amazon was the award-winning graphic novel trilogy March by Congressman and civil rights activist John Lewis, co-authored by Andrew Adine and illustrated by Nate Powell. It's an insider's look at the civil rights movement and definitely a must-read. Now, the reasons for its current status are many and interesting, and they could be the subject of a whole other podcast, but I want to focus more narrowly on how far graphic novels in general have come in their acceptance as legitimate works of art. I have to admit, I'm a latecomer as a graphic novel enthusiast. Part of it was that as a child, I was an indifferent comic book reader, and then later as an English major, I developed a sort of snobbery regarding books with pictures. I mean, shouldn't the words be enough to tell the story? Or some kind of nonsense like that. I have no doubt that when I first heard the phrase graphic novel, my response involved rolling my eyes. It was my son who helped knock all that nonsense out of my brain. It started with the Captain Underpants books, which my wife and I would read to him when he was little. They were a lot of fun, and I had to admit they couldn't have really been done any other way. Still, I could pretend they were just silly kids' books and keep my snobbery intact. Then we read the Bone books by Jeff Smith, and the walls of my obstinacy came tumbling down. Here was an epic story full of humor and suspense and big emotions, and it was really, really good. More so, I couldn't imagine it being done any other way except as a graphic novel. And so, and not for the first time, I had to admit I was wrong. More recently, and having nothing at all to do with my own eye-opening moment, graphic novels for children have started to gain more acceptance. In 2015, El Defo by C.C. Bell was given a Newbery Honor, and in 2016, the same happened to Roller Girl by Victoria Jameson. So, if you're anything like I was, give a graphic novel a chance, or at the very least, don't discourage your child from reading one. Besides the ones I've just mentioned, you could also check out the Amulet series by Kazu Kibuishi, the Baby Mouse books by Jennifer Holmes, or the illustrated novels of Brian Selznick, such as The Marvels or The Invention of Hugo Cabret. Or just wander into the graphic novel section of your local bookstore, pull down a book, and start reading. All right, my guest today is Jennifer Baker, a writer, editor, and educator. In addition, she's a panel organizer for the nonprofit organization We Need Diverse Books and host of the podcast Minorities in Publishing. Her website is called Jennifer N. Baker, which can be found at www.jennifernbaker.com. Thank you for joining me today, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Now, as I mentioned, you're associated with We Need Diverse Books, and their mission statement is putting more books featuring diverse characters into the hands of all children. What do you think most people misunderstand about the call for diversity in children's books?
Well, in terms of the name, We Need Diverse Books, I think it does sound kind of one-sided in terms of wanting to just put more books into the hands of more marginalized representation into the hands of children all over the nation as well as the world so that they see themselves in books. So I think one of the things that we've seen that's the misinterpretation of this quote-unquote diversity movement is people saying, oh, well, you just need anything. You just need books. So I'll turn this character who is straight gay. I'll turn this character who's white into Latino. And not really thinking about what cultures are, what representation and being part of a demographic means, that it's just so easy to do, that anyone could and should do it, and that there's not really a kind of understanding of why we're not seeing those stories and just kind of just putting whatever you can find out there, which also presents bad representation. It's not just getting these books into people's hands, it's getting responsible, respectful representation out into the world as well. So people see themselves as well as other cultures and people aren't pigeonholed.
Now, the book you chose is Mufaro's Beautiful Daughters by John Steptoe. Yeah, it was originally published in 1987 by Lothrop Lee and Shepard. And what can you tell readers who are unfamiliar with this book, what it's all about?
It's actually an African folk tale. And John Steptoe sadly died soon after this book came out. I first heard about this book through Reading Rainbow. I was born in 81 and Reading Rainbow was pretty big at the time. And so I'd watch Reading Rainbow and then, you know, the stories are narrated. And then I went and ask my mom to take me to the library to get this book. And it's such a beautiful tale. And on Reading Rainbow, for those that remember it, and it's kind of resurfacing in a way, they show you the illustrations as they're narrating the book. And it's just so delicate. And it gets all those fine lines. It presents all these beautiful, the lavish landscape of Africa. And it has centers two daughters, one who's good and one who's bad, kind of those prototypical roles in, that you see in, you know, Disney movies, say. And a lesson is learned. As in through any folktale, folktales are about a lesson learned and not just a story. It has an arc, but it always has the arc that lands at, and this is how we all learned, and this is why this is the way it is. And I think it's just such a masterfully told tale, but it's also one of the few ones that was available at the time, because we didn't see them in the 80s. We don't see them as much now even. And the fact that it's called Mufaro's Beautiful Daughters, it's not Mufaro's Daughters, it's not the daughters, it's not African folktale, it's Mufaro's Beautiful Daughters, centering beauty with Africa.
Is that what particularly sort of drew you to that book? This is something that wasn't seen a lot of, like you said, even now, but it was something kind of unique during its time that drew you to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so funny because when you presented the question and then I listened to previous episodes of the podcast, what I would usually go to is, oh, I read a lot of Babysitter's Club, I read a lot of Fear Street, but they weren't really representative and they weren't indicative of what you would hope to see, of the range of what we're not seeing, but also that it wasn't putting Africa in this kind of poor landscape, colonized landscape. It didn't center the colonization or white people taking over Africa. It centered the African people. The African people were happy. The African people were beautiful. And it was just something that you don't feel sorry for the characters in this book. And I think that's really what drew me back to it in terms of revisiting it in my 30s, when I remember it so vividly when I was less than 10, say six. I was probably six, seven around the time I first read this book. So it did have a lasting effect of, wow, I see such beauty in this book. And then 30 years later, recognizing that beauty and what it means to see that representation that we still don't see, you know, what is it, 20 years after this book came out, 20, 30 years after this book came out. So it's definitely indicative of the fact that it was something we didn't see, but that is celebrated.
And you've talked a little bit about this. The full title of the book is Mufaro's Beautiful Daughters, An African Tale. And the original source of the story was these tales collected from the Zimbabwe region. And according to the liner notes, the illustrations themselves were inspired by this old trade city in Zimbabwe. Oh, and you, like I said, you talked a little bit about this, but what's the importance of this very specific African setting?
Well, like I was mentioning, is when I recall what my visuals were of Africa in media, and media including books, including TV, including music, if it did really connect in that way, was Save the Children, right? They're so poor. They had distended bellies. They're crying. They're living, you know, they're outside. Flies are around their hair. Like, oh, it's so decrepit. Poor, poor African children. And African was a monolith. It wasn't looking at these specific regions. It was, oh, Africa as a whole is this kind of decrepit nation, which is not true. So when you see this book and you see the daughters and you see that they have gold in their hair and that their hairs are perfectly braided and that they're in their kind of traditional dress and it fits their bodies and that they have attitude and that they're selfless and that, you know, when she finds the prince and he's handsome and he's very well dressed, and yes, it's kind of tribal in a way. But it's also contemporary in the fact that they're appreciating the beauty of the land and nature. And I think that interaction, the view, the illustration plus the interaction of the characters with the space and with each other is what we weren't seeing and what we don't see. And that's so key to what Steptoe did with this piece. And you could see that he loves what he's presenting and that he put a lot of love into it.
Now, there are a lot of parallels in this story and your classic Cinderella story. You have a young girl trying her best who escapes unfortunate circumstances with some help from magic. And this is a story you find in all sorts of different forms throughout the world. For example, like in Iraq, there's a folk tale, The Little Red Fish and the Clog of Gold. In China, there's the story of Ye Shen. In Norway, there's the story of Katie Wooden Cloak. And that's just to name a few. There's so many stories throughout the world that had this sort of common theme. What is it, you think, about this particular story that has such a universal appeal? At the same time, what makes Mufaro's Beautiful Daughters unique compared to the sort of the basic Cinderella story?
Well, it is interesting because when you're reading this book, it does have those, like I mentioned earlier, those Disney parallels, right? The evil family, whether it be the stepmother, the stepsister, and then the good one, the good-hearted one who wouldn't do anything bad. And it's kind of one-dimensional in that way of, okay, well, we set this up in such and such fashion that you kind of can predict what's going to happen. But then you have, you know, the fantastical elements of dealing with nature and animals, you know, like the snake and the selflessness of one daughter, the selfishness of the other, seeing the punishment, but also the punishment. It's interesting when I think back to Disney movies is they kind of become decrepit and, you know, they kind of go off stage. And even with the kind of, I guess, lesson learned is that she still loves her sister at the end of this book, even though she's a brat. Yeah. So we don't even, you know, even Steptoe doesn't even go there in terms of how he modifies or however he chose to modify this tale of saying, okay, and then the sisters just hated each other for the rest of eternity. Like, there's still love there between the family. I think that's unique to it too, is like you could take a lot of folk tales, and folk tales do kind of overlap. I mean, we are kind of regurgitating similar stories from different areas of the world and not always giving those regions credit, as you say. And a lot of picture books we see have those folk tales, or middle grade novels we're seeing more of. And that's what it'd be great to see more in terms of the diversity of books, is that, oh, this is actually a Trinidadian folk tale, but the way we hear it, you know, it feels American. But, you know, colonialism happened everywhere. So you hear folk tales that are tied to it. But it may seem American-centric, but it's not American-centric. It's because so many nations were, colonized.
Now, you mentioned this is a folk tale. Now, a lot of times folk tales or fables, the basic idea is to teach children a lesson about, you know, being honest or being good to other people. And what is it about the idea of telling stories to children to teach them a lesson, as opposed to sort of just telling them, try to be good or, you know, be an honest person, but instead telling them a story to encourage them? That seems to have, I think, more of an impact. This is a universal thing as well, that we tell stories to put impressions upon children.
It's kind of funny that they also put animals a lot. Yeah, you always see the animal. In this one, there are the animals as well. Snow White had the animals. Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid. Animals are a big thing too. And Beauty and the Beast also had inanimate objects that were actually made given human function. So I think it's kind of like this seeing the world on an even playing field in a way of everything has feelings, everybody has feelings, everyone has the capacity to do good or bad. And then showing that, well, in the end, badness doesn't win. And sometimes that badness is a very exaggerated badness, like, you know, the bratty sister who, even in the beginning, Manyara, she's the bratty sister, and she's basically tells her sister, you get too much attention and I don't like that. And her sister, Nyasha, is like, oh, well, okay, that sucks. And it's a little like, you know, like who, as a child, what child is usually, children are pretty direct at having worked with them, but do you have that foresight to recognize your own jealousy? So thus we present it in the page as very concrete and not even something that could be negotiated. Is this person's bad? We all agree, right? Yes. And then this person's good. So you have the extreme on both sides, and presenting that in this kind of adventurous way of getting to that next level of human realization or self-realization. I think it's about the hero journey. And that's what attracts kids, is this sense of adventure. So we make it a journey. And it seems adventurous. And then in this particular book, Nyasha has to go through these challenges. And her sister also goes through the challenges, and seeing how each of them react to them is what kind of, it's kind of a competition, a very muted Hunger Games, if you will, of, you know, okay, well, you came out well, you didn't come out well, and we have the evidence for that. So it's a very interesting way to present a lesson to children, and also potentially make them feel like they can be part of that. So that's what I think of in terms of when we present folktales, and the folktales that I've read, especially Zora Neale Hurston. It happens to be her birthday today. You know, in her tales, you know, it was always this kind of stepping stone to get to this point. And sometimes in her work, which was based on oral tales, it's more a growing pain lesson of adults and like cheating husbands and things like that. But you wouldn't necessarily bring that to the children's landscape. So then you put in the animals, you put in this lavish and colorful presentation, you put in sister relationships, which is identifiable. You put it in Africa in this case. You make Africa not this destitute nation, but this gorgeous landscape. And you give them something that's identifiable, which is affection, wanting affection from their father, wanting affection from people, and understanding that to be good is rewarding in itself.
There's one detail I wanted to ask you about. It's a detail that kind of stuck out for me because it was just so odd, and I couldn't quite figure out what to make of it. It's that man with the head under his arm that Manyara is told to be polite to, and of course she isn't. And then he sort of goes away. We don't really hear much about him. And it's just, I mean, I like the detail, but at the same time, everything else in the story made sense to me, except that one particular, I couldn't quite figure out how he fit into that. I was just wondering what you thought about this particular detail of the story.
I don't know. It's something you kind of gloss over pretty easily, because it seemed to kind of hit the nail on the head that she's just not into helping anybody. And that was another kind of hurdle for her to be good. Like, she's given chance after chance after chance to try, and she's still not. And so all these manifestations happen, whether they're, you know, these kind of godlike creatures, presentations, or even the animals, and she still falters in that. And it's very interesting.
Oh, that makes sense to me. Are there any particular passages in this book that stand out for you that you'd like to share with us?
Well, it was funny because when we were talking about it, just in thinking about what stuck out is that he being John Steptoe, presents it pretty matter-of-factly in the beginning of this is their relationship, the sister relationship. So I was thinking about the sister relationship and how that's presented or introduced, especially for people who are picture book writers or emerging or aspiring picture book writers, of how much you have to do with so little. And I think he did it very well on that point, not just the illustration, but incorporating that, and also how it balances on the page. So for those who have or haven't read it, when you see how the words really comparatively work with the imagery he's created and how he's building those characters, it's just gorgeous. It's amazing. This is the beginning passage, as mentioned. Manyara was almost always in a bad temper. She teased her sister whenever their father's back was turned, and she had been heard to say, "Someday, Nyasha, I will be a queen, and you will be a servant in my household." "If that should come to pass," Nyasha responded, "I will be pleased to serve you. But why do you say such things? You are clever and strong and beautiful. Why are you so unhappy?" "Because everyone talks about how kind you are, and they praise everything you do," Manyara replied. "I'm certain that father loves you best. But when I am a queen, everyone will know that your silly kindness is only weakness."
For the readers who come to this book and, you know, really enjoy it, and as I've enjoyed it, can you think of the other sort of any kind of books that they might search out based on their own appreciation of this particular book?
What's interesting is John Steptoe's son, Javaka Steptoe, he recently had a book out. It's on Basquiat. It's called Radiant Child, the story of young Jean-Michel Basquiat. And it's nominated for an NAACP Image Award. And hopefully it may win a Caldecott when it's announced later this month as of recording. And his picture book is gorgeous. And it's telling history. And it's talking about a figure that I think many young readers may not know about. And I think young readers, because it is also a picture book. And he does collages in terms of how he's presenting the material, as well as telling the story of young Basquiat rising through the ranks and even some of his troubles. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And it's so interesting that it's literally father and son comparatively, really looking into African-American or really Black culture and presenting it to such a young audience in such a stark way visually, as well as the sparse language. And I'd also suggest Don Tate's A Poet. It's about George Moses, who was the first published Black poet in America, and he was published when he was a slave. And now those are more historical in nature, but in terms of what they're presenting, I just think there's such, especially Don's book, I don't think they're recognized as much as they should be in terms of what they're presenting that's different of Black culture in picture books and showing the sad with the happy, with the joys, and recognizing that people have triumphed through so many things and that you could still be creative and masterful and successful, however you measure success in what you do.
Well, thank you very much for those suggestions, and thank you so much for joining me today to talk about this book.
Oh, thank you so much. I love this book. So I heartily recommend, if people do not have John Steptoe's work, period, please get it.
Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music, titled All Together, is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purple-planet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can find out more about me at jleemott.com. That's jleemott.com. Or contact me at jodymott@gmail.com. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.